Rolling.
This is the FedSoc Films Podcast,
where we continue the conversation sparked on film.
Quiet on set.
You want to know what freedom tastes like? It tastes like this beer.
Take one.
This is, in fact, the classic solution in search of a problem.
Action.
That cannot help but be controversial.
Cut.
With expert discussion and analysis.
With the greatest legal minds on the topic today.
The FedSoc Films Podcast.
It's a wrap.
All right, I'm going to level with you. I don't like the idea of someone being able to see what I do on my smartphone. It's not that there's something that I'm trying to hide. That's what everyone says, right? But I'm a private person, and my taste in memes is no one's business but my own. But that isn't to say that there aren't arguments, and very good arguments, for allowing the government to access citizens' digital data under certain circumstances. Salutations, and welcome back to the FedSoc Films Podcast. I'm Anne Hartley, your reclusive host. We made a film called Cats on the Internet about the development of the third-party doctrine and its relationship to the data on your phone. I have here with me John Richter, a partner at the law firm King & Spalding and a former United States attorney. Hi, John, and welcome.
Hi, Anne. Great to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. So what did you think of our film, Cats on the Internet?
Well, I thought it was really, really fun. I'm more of a dog person, but I thought it was a great foundation for laying out the state of play as it pertains to the Fourth Amendment and how that applies with all these emerging technologies in which everyone is sharing so much information outside with third parties.
Absolutely. If you had to pick one of these technologies, which one do you think is having the biggest impact here?
Well, I think it is our smartphones, right? They make it easy to connect with everyone. Everybody is on all these social media sites. People are communicating, whether it's through text or it's through other means, messaging means on these different applications and platforms. But basically, now we conduct our daily lives largely through smartphones and countless, you know, internet companies maintain records about us and for us. And so, you know, much of the information that we consider personal is now residing on third-party servers. I know there is a notice that is posted, I'm told, at the CIA that says, remember, the cloud is just someone else's server. So I think, you know, that is obviously wrapped up in what you articulated at the outset as some sense that you want to protect your privacy and you're not comfortable with the fact that all these third parties have your information, but everybody loves the technology.
All right. So we have these third-party doctrines who just have a hold of so much data through our smartphones. So what sort of data are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about all kinds of information, right? It's information about that's substantive in communications, but we're also talking about what is essentially the data that's created attendant to the things that we do. So we all, when we're using a phone or we're communicating with others, we create information and we convey information. The technology then has its own separate information that gets created. So for example, if you take a picture on your iPhone, all kinds of metadata accompanies that. That's why you can look on your iPhone and it'll tell you when the picture was taken and oftentimes will tell you where the picture was taken. And you can opt out of that, but you have to take an active step to do that. So the point is that with all electronic information, there are essentially signatures and information that accompanies that is not the actual substance of the communication, but can be useful and can provide and can have substantive implications for law enforcement.
What sort of implications?
Well, the most common is location data, for example, where you were at a particular time in the court. The United States Supreme Court has had to grapple with that in certain cases. We know, of course, historically speaking, when you were walking around out in public, people could see you. And if they could see you, then obviously at some level you weren't in a private space insofar as people knowing your whereabouts. What's interesting about GPS technology, and particularly that GPS technology and location data that accompanies you with your smartphone, is that it's historical in nature. So it not only tells you where you are now potentially, but it can tell you where you were going back in time. And obviously, at the time of the founding, when the Fourth Amendment was passed, being able to have a device that could track a person was not known. And so this technology then raises questions about whether and to what degree such information about where you are at a particular time in the past, for example, is something that law enforcement should be able to obtain through a subpoena, or whether that information requires and implicates the Fourth Amendment and requires a showing of probable cause.
Sure. So in your experience as a federal prosecutor, did you ever have to use the third-party doctrine to access this sort of digital data?
Well, yes. And when I was the United States attorney, we were still, it was pre the Carpenter case, which is a case from 2018 out of the United States Supreme Court that addressed some of these issues. At the time, we were basically able still to use a law that had been passed by Congress to use to serve subpoenas. We were regularly, of course, always still using pen registers, which pen registers just gives essentially phone numbers. But we certainly used GPS tracking and locational data, both in cases where we were looking to identify whether a potential suspect may have been in the area or location of a crime that had been committed, or in situations in which we were searching for someone. So many times in kidnapping cases or in these kinds of situations in which you're looking for a person, you may be looking either for the potential victim, or you may be looking for a person whom it is suspected that victim may be traveling with, and using such data to try to identify where they may have traveled to and where they may be found in order to rescue the person who it's understood to have been taken wrongfully. So those were some of the experiences that I recall from my days as a federal prosecutor.
That really does sound like it would be an extremely useful tool. Now, in these situations you're talking about, do you think you would have been able to accomplish the same outcome in the case if you hadn't had access to this data?
It would depend. Obviously, police were solving cases long before we had such data. But this information is extraordinarily useful, and it's extraordinarily useful for both, identifying the guilty, but it's also that can be valuable for exonerating the innocent, right? So many times you may have, let's take a hypothetical of a situation in which someone's, a child's been kidnapped. The fingers may get pointed at a particular person. The question is did that person do it? And if location data would say that the person was nowhere near the location of that child at any of the relevant periods of time, it may actually help law enforcement eliminate possible suspects and focus on the real perpetrator, the more likely perpetrators, sooner and faster. So this technology and the use of this information is very important to solving crime, to protecting lives, and frankly, protecting liberties of those persons who may be harmed by crimes. And so ultimately, when we're talking about this subject, we're talking about it in the context of the Fourth Amendment, but we're ultimately talking about it as a societal standpoint, a balance between the need for law enforcement to have tools to take action, necessary action to protect us and to hold persons accountable who commit crimes, as well as balancing, of course, and taking into account our civil liberties and making sure that our constitutional rights are respected and protected.
Right. It's I would imagine is a bit of a challenge to try to balance those two, right?
Well, sure. And the court is, the United States Supreme Court and the lower courts are really struggling with that and have for a while. And part of that is that, as you said at the top of the show, this expectation that people have about their privacy and this notion, this modern sensibility of our privacy is not perfectly aligned with the plain text of the Fourth Amendment. And that, I think, therein lies a tension, which is that we want somehow more protection than perhaps the plain language of the Fourth Amendment by itself conveys if read pretty strictly. And so given that the Fourth Amendment's text doesn't provide a perfect rubric, the court has been struggling for decades now to come up with a construct that is uniform in application that can draw clear lines between when government and law enforcement must seek a search warrant and when they can use a lesser means like a subpoena to obtain information that they may have Fourth Amendment or at least privacy implications.
Sure. So I know you mentioned Carpenter as one of those cases that certainly looms large there, but are there any particular notable ones besides that?
Well, Carpenter is a long list, and the court has most of the jurisprudence in this area is relatively modern. You know, it really is in the late 1960s in the Warren Court that the Supreme Court really began to use this terminology of reasonable expectations of privacy. Remember, the Fourth Amendment states that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. So this terminology of privacy is a construct that is sort of superimposed. And when you look at the Carpenter case, you see the iteration and all the variations of the views. But when the court in the case Katz, that your podcast from last year covered, that case, you know, from 1967 basically said that a Fourth Amendment violation occurs when the government violates an expectation of privacy that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable. And you can see how that language, while attractive, is at some levels at odds with the plain language of the Fourth Amendment. And ironically, in that decision, which I think was seen perhaps as potentially making the Fourth Amendment more protective, in fact, with the emergence of all this technology in which we are now sharing so much information with third parties, the creation, this notion of what is an expectation of privacy that is reasonable that a person would have evolved. And so you had follow-on cases like Smith v. Maryland and United States v. Miller, in which basically persons having provided information to third parties, basically then the court concluded meant that, well, you shared that information with a third party, therefore you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy, and therefore the Fourth Amendment wasn't implicate. And taken to its logical end, therefore, if you extend this expectation of privacy notion, you could certainly make the argument that if you're using your smartphone and you're sharing all this information onto a server that's controlled by other persons and therefore can be accessed by other persons, at least a good portion of the information may, in fact, not be subject to the Fourth Amendment, particularly to the degree that it is not information that is actually yours. So we know that, for example, our cell phone providers collect all kinds of information about us through the use of our cell phones that is not actually our communications. Again, it's their records. It's their information. And so if you were to apply Katz strictly and the progeny that followed in the Smith and the Miller cases, arguably a lot of this information would not require a search warrant. And the court in 2018, the Supreme Court in the Carpenter case, I think struggled with that. And I think there's been an evolution in more recent years to recognize that Katz in some ways is too open-ended and too malleable because reasonable expectations of privacy at a particular time and place obviously change over time. And as technology changes, what we share with third parties changes. And that means essentially that the Fourth Amendment becomes very unhinged from the plain language and doesn't provide certain clear areas that are protected, or at least becomes unsatisfying as we move in and share more and more information. And that's what the court is struggled with in the Carpenter case, and I think continues to struggle and likely will continue to struggle here as more cases come before it.
Gotcha. So do you think there's a way to reconcile smartphones and, you know, this new technology with the text of the Fourth Amendment that was written before anyone even had a concept of what this would have been? Or are we all going to need to throw out our smartphones?
Well, first, I think we all have to be mindful of what we share and recognize that, you know, what we think we are sort of keeping in the cloud is really on someone else's server. And I think sometimes that's lost. I think there's a general consensus that somehow limitations need to be made. But the three kind of approaches that you see embodied in the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence all have certain unsatisfying aspects to them, which is why this area of law remains a bit unsettled. I mean, I think if you think about the state of play, there are kind of three options. You know, the first is essentially to stick with kind of Smith and Miller and this notion of if you share information with a third party, you just got to live with the consequences. Obviously, what that means potentially is that as modern technology has evolved, our Fourth Amendment rights in the information that we have in smartphones is kind of reduced to nearly nothing. Obviously, that's a choice, but it's not a choice that I think the majority of people find very satisfying. And certainly the court, a majority of the court has not, even in decisions in which there's not unanimity in the decision. You know, I think a second choice is to sort of set cases like Smith and Miller aside and try kind of to use the Katz reasonable expectation privacy language and superimpose sort of judicial judgment about whether and to what degree private persons would have a reasonable expectation in privacy and what it is that society, unquote, is willing to recognize. I think that option, while attractive in certain respects because it allows the potential to protect more information and keep it that information or at least raise the bar and require a search warrant based on probable cause to get that information in a criminal investigation, it does have a couple of downsides. One, it's judges making decisions about what societal expectations are, so it's quite malleable. Certainly not a bright line test that's very workable and usable as new technologies come in for law enforcement, and that means law enforcement may get it wrong because they don't know it. what the rule actually is. And then also, of course, the cats, the language of cats, and this notion of privacy as embodied in that case and the subsequent cases that have followed doesn't really track the actual language of the Fourth Amendment. And to the degree you move beyond the plain language of the text of the constitutional amendment, you also introduce all kinds of collateral complications in the law. I think the third possibility is obviously to look to get back to those basics of what the plain text of the law or the constitutional amendment is. But even that, of course, is still a struggle. I think at some level, if you look at the text and the original understanding of the amendment, there are some advantages, right? Obviously, judges are supposed to decide cases on democratically legitimate sources of law, like positive law, rather than on their own personal policy preferences. And so if you tie it to the text and positive law, then presumably it increases the legitimacy of the judicial decision. Where I think the court has struggled to date is trying to define then what that positive law would be beyond, obviously, their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Clearly, that plain language means it has that, you know, at some level, each person and each person's house and each person's papers and each person's effects somehow have Fourth Amendment implications. And there is a personal interest that seems to be embodied in that. If we take a too strict a view on it being tied to pure property rights, however, obviously there's a lot of information that isn't actually ours, but we may have some expectation or desire for control of that information. So the fact that a third party has access to or possession in your papers and effects doesn't necessarily eliminate your interest in them. But defining it, you know, you can't just define it strictly through concepts of property law and automatically cover probably all of the information that you may believe you have an interest in, even if you don't quote own it, given that assuming of course that it's in the possession of a third party. So I think if you look, you know, where the court's got to consider going is if you're thinking about it as a tying it to a more originalist view of the text of the Fourth Amendment, you've got to come up with a construct about, well, if I don't have complete ownership or exclusive control of this information, how do I define it? What is the positive law? What are those concepts that might apply there? And I think the answer there is that that's not yet really been established, but it is an opportunity for perhaps Congress and our elected officials to speak on the subject and help define those expectations, because societal expectations as a matter in a democratic republic are supposed to be embodied through the laws passed by our elected officials. And that, I think, probably is the most satisfying way from a legal standpoint that we address where the line is in terms of when you need a search warrant and when you don't, assuming you're getting into a place that is beyond the plain language of the Fourth Amendment.
What you've said here makes an awful lot of sense. Well, thank you for joining us, John. I feel like I've learned a lot today.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you, Anne.
Thank you, folks, for listening in. You can find the link to our film, Cats on the Internet, in the description on our YouTube channel or at fedsoc.org. That's FEDSOC.org. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. That's a wrap.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.